On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For photographer Tom Murphy, Yellowstone in winter is not just magic, it's home for long stretches and unforgettable images. Sparkling cottonwood trees, snow-covered bison beside the steaming geysers, tall pines bent in the wind. This hour On Point, we're going deep into Yellowstone National Park in winter with Tom Murphy, a man who knows it like few others. You can join the conversation. Does this sound like your fantasy, to be in the middle of Yellowstone right now under the big snowy pines? Joining me now from Bozeman, Montana, is photographer Tom Murphy. Every winter now for 27 years, he's been heading deep, really deep, into Yellowstone National Park, capturing images of the extraordinary snowbound landscape and wildlife there. He's put some between covers in his book Silence and Solitude, Yellowstone's Winter Wilderness. He's featured in the PBS Nature documentary Christmas in Yellowstone, which airs Christmas Eve across the country. You can see a gallery of Tom's photos at our website, onpointradio.org. In Bozeman, Montana, Tom Murphy, thanks very much for joining us.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So what are your plans this year? When are you headed in?
Well, it's snowing right now, so it's pretty encouraging. I'm going to Antarctica for the month of January, but right after that I'll be in Yellowstone for about 6 weeks.
Oh, you do like the cold. And yes, I see here the weather report today, 90% precipitation, so I guess it's happening. 6 degrees was the low, temperatures in the teens forecast for the days ahead. And in January, paint us a picture. What does it look like?
Well, hopefully it'll be white, accumulating as many as 2 or 3 feet in the interior of the park. And what will happen, hopefully, in January while I'm gone into Antarctica is it'll settle and provide a really good base for skiing. And so generally I prefer to ski in backcountry of Yellowstone in February and early March because you get a better base and then hopefully fresh snow on top for a good surface.
So you get your cross-country skis on. I think I read here at one point you did 100-mile trek across Yellowstone, if I've got that right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a little longer than that, actually. I did a solo trip from Jackson Hole to Mammoth. It was 125 miles in 14 days, and that was a solo trip, like I said. And then I've done it, skied across Yellowstone diagonally one time, 110 miles in 12 days.
Diagonally across Yellowstone, I love it. You know, I want to hear all about that. But and I'm looking here at these images. They're absolutely magnificent. Of course, those peaks and the geysers, tremendous volcanic activity there, and the wildlife, it's all stunning. It's what most Americans don't see. 3 million visitors a year to these 2.2 million acres, but almost all of them in the summertime. Let me ask you, Tom Murphy, what does the wildlife of Yellowstone make of you when you're out there with your big pack and your cross-country skis and your camera in winter? Do they see you as predator, as oddball, as a threat, or just another bit of nature?
Well, probably a little bit of everything. Mostly they're surprised because they don't see people wandering around on two legs with these big pack on their backs very often. And so they're a tendency to be standoffish at first, but my goal as a wildlife photographer is to have a presence there, a non-threatening presence. I approach this job of mine as a visitor in their living room, and so I travel around in a non-threatening way as possible, and that way they hopefully view me as a benign oddball, basically.
And who's really out in the winter? The bears and bats and wood frogs hibernating. So who are the kings of Yellowstone when the snow comes in?
The main presence in the lower elevations. High elevations are virtually no wildlife at all. Snow depths are too great. It's too cold and windy. So the elk and the bison come down to lower elevations. And, of course, then the predators follow the prey. So a lot of wolf activity is concentrated in the lower valleys. So, you know, it's beautiful landscapes at the high elevations, and I go there too. But the wildlife concentrations are mostly in the northern and lower elevations, around the geyser basins too. They hang around by the hot tubs.
Mm. The so-called hot tubs. I love that.
Right.
I want to begin to get some of the stories of these photographs. I'm looking at one here right now. And listeners, if you're at a computer, you can see these at onpointradio.org. An astounding photograph here of a big bull elk with its snout, big snout, way down into a steaming pond. It's so volcanic there in Yellowstone. And I guess rooting for reeds, for food in the warmth of that steaming pond with the winter all around. Tell us about this photo, Tom.
It was a bad winter, and you can see the antlers are all beat up and the tips are broken off.
Yeah.
And it was pretty thin. It's been a long winter already, and that's unusual behavior that they sort of acting like a moose, sticking their face in the water. Mm-hmm. So it shows you how desperate he was to get something to eat. And basically, that kind of behavior, that was shot in February a few years back. And to put it bluntly, I don't think he made it. He probably starved to death because he was in pretty tough shape.
Sort of going to extremes to find something at the mm-hmm. bottom of that thermal pond. But what an image. The thermal quality of Yellowstone comes through so powerfully in the winter. I mean, we see the geysers all year round, but the steam that comes up, remind us of what lies beneath Yellowstone National Park.
Well, the mantle of the earth is closer than it is in most places in the world, so the subterranean rock, even down about 1,000 feet, is very, very hot. So the water percolating down through the matrix of the rock gets superheated and thrown back up somehow. It percolates up through the cracks in the earth and comes out as hot springs or geysers or mud pots or steam vents called fumaroles. So it's a spectacular place. In the summertime, the air temperature may be in the 50s to 80s, and there's still steam, but when it's 30, 40 below zero, it's just spectacular. You have these clouds of steam that'll cover the landscape, will climb 1,000 feet in the air, and then all the frost, you know, big flaky crystals of frost, just like feathers all over everything, and it's just a magical time. It's much more beautiful, I think. The thermals are much more beautiful in the winter than they are in the summer.
No little bit of that ice and snow sticking to the great shaggy coats of the buffalo, the bison in Yellowstone. And you've got some astounding photographs of them stoically covered in snow with the geysers behind, the steam around. What's the buffalo behavior in the winter?
Well, they're mostly enduring. They put on as much fat as they can in the late summer and autumn. And hopefully if they've got enough reserves, they can make it. They say a bison needs to eat about 50 pounds of food a day, and they can't get that in the wintertime. So they just make it up by consuming their own fat. And, you know, if it's a short winter or an easier winter, they'll make it. You know, it's weather is the limitation for these animals. So the strong ones and the younger ones generally will make it. The older ones in a bad winter won't.
And when they're practically snow-covered, ice-covered, do they mind? Or is that so far out at the end of the shaggy covering that it doesn't make a difference to them?
It's exactly right.
They look like
so
mounds,
well.
Mountains, horned mountains.
That's
or
right.
Mounds in
That's
the snow
right.
practically.
Yeah, they. You think, they're freezing to death. But the truth is that hair has insulated them so well that even their internal body heat doesn't radiate out enough to melt that frost. Of course, you know, if it's 40 below zero, like some of my photographs of bison are all covered with frost, why, I look like that too. my mustache and my eyebrows and my mittens and all that stuff get completely covered with frost just like them. But as long as the internal core temperature is fine, they're going to make it. But again, it's tough on them.
The enduring. Let's get a little bit of that buffalo snort in our ears here from Yellowstone. We've got a little bit of tape here. they're speaking to you.
That's right.
Hello, bison.
They sound to me like 2,000-pound pigs, actually.
Yes, they do right there. If they're enduring, what on earth are you doing out there? How do you manage to live in Yellowstone for days and weeks at a time in the middle of this winter?
Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch in western South Dakota and with experience of a lot of cold. And when I was a little kid, I used to get really cold fingers, and I guess I killed a lot of nerve endings or something. But it doesn't bother me so much. I have froze one toe one time, but that's generally the only problem I've had. I really can't explain it. It's mostly a mental thing, I believe. If you think you can do it and you pay attention to the weather, cold is not malicious in any respect, but you have to respect it. It's going to be right there an inch from your face. And so as long as you maintain your own clothing, and don't get wet, don't overheat yourself and start to sweat, I've been fine. I really can't explain why. It's just most people think it's crazy, but and there's probably a little truth to that, but because it's much more difficult experience to travel in that kind of cold. Because, again, it's completely surrounding you, and if you're not careful, it'll grab you.
To travel in it and then to photograph in it. I mean, you've got shot after shot that just makes the jaw drop here, the creatures and the snow-covered terrain and mountaintops. Are you gloved and swaddled all around the face when you get the camera out and you're at your work here?
Well, I have to shoot the camera barehanded. Can't handle the buttons without bare fingers, yeah. So a time or two, something's happening really nice. And I continue to shoot. Pretty soon, I can't feel the camera. My hands are numb, so I have to look and see if my finger's even touching the button. So that's happened a number of times. But as soon as I'm done, of course, stick my hands in my armpits and whatever, and try to warm up again. But it's wildlife photography is a lot of patience, waiting, and then when something happens, shooting like crazy after that peak of action So a lot of times I'm just kind of standing around or skiing around looking for things. But when it happens, I get cold for a while. That's true.
I guess you would. We've got Faith calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Faith. You're on the air with Tom Murphy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had the opportunity to be in Yellowstone twice in the wintertime, and I'm going again this February.
Lucky you.
I know, and I'm very excited by it. It is the most magical place. The geyser basin with the snow on the trees, it almost looks like a Dr. Seuss landscape sometimes. I wanted to find out if there are any good sources for maps, and also... I've gone to the Old Faithful area, and I was wondering if there's any access to any of the other geyser areas from the Old Faithful Lodge, which is where I'll be staying in February.
You've got the expert here, Tom Murphy. What's your advice to Faith?
The best source of maps is the USGS out of Virginia. You can order them online, or usually good outdoor shops will have USGS 7.5-minute maps. In terms of getting to other geyser basins, from Old Faithful, if you want to ski, why, there's all kinds of wonderful places. The Shoshone Geyser Basin is about 12-mile ski to the southeast up over Grants Pass, and that's no boardwalks, and it's a backcountry geyser basin. The Midway Geyser Basin, of course, is accessible via your snow coach. And then the Lower Geyser Basin. So those are the ones that are closest and fairly easy to get to.
Tom, give us a sense of the Yellowstone topography. You've got the Continental Divide running right through it. You've got some big expanses of water there. But is it consistent? Is it very different from top to bottom? It's a great big chunk of Wyoming spilling over into a little bit of Montana and Idaho there. What's the sort of terrain feel, top to bottom, east to west?
It varies a great deal. That's one of the things I love about the place. You've got the spectacular mountains. Eagle Peak in the Absaroka Mountains is almost 12,000 feet. And then down to the area around Gardner along the Yellowstone and Gardner Rivers, it's a rain shadow and very little snow, relatively warm, at about 5,000 feet. So somebody asked me how much snow there is in Yellowstone Park. If you're at Gardner, there's probably 2 inches. If you're at the south end of Yellowstone Lake, there's probably 10 feet. So it's wildly variable.
And the Weather Channel forecast today, 15 degrees tomorrow, and it says grab your snowshoes. We're going deep into the Yellowstone winter this hour with photographer Tom Murphy. He spent 27-plus now going on winters in Yellowstone. You can see a terrific gallery of his photos, and there's something else at our website, onpointradio.org. And they really are something. I want to look at a few more of these. Tom, we talked about the elk a bit. I love the photos you've got of them going single file across great expanses of that snowy terrain, I guess, so that only the first ones have to break the snow and not everyone. Very, very efficiently minded, these elk.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's kind of hard on the ones in front, I'm sure, but the rest of them are lazy back there. Sometimes the ones in front get tired and somebody else will take over, but usually the ones in back are content to let the ones in front do all the work.
I'm looking here at sunset on the side of the face of a red Fox, just absolutely surrounded by ice and snow. I've seen other photos in your book of them leaping to go after food, mice, I guess, in the winter. How does the fox make out in the Yellowstone winter?
They do pretty well, actually. That particular fox was in the Lamar Valley, and there's about 3 feet of snow on the ground, and they can't, of course, see this mouse down there. And the mice live on the top of the ground under this blanket of snow, so it's a great insulator, and they're pretty comfortable down there. But they're always listening for something going on above their heads. So the fox does it as quietly and carefully as he can, and he can hear them rustling and chewing on seeds and stuff underneath. So when he sees or hears an opportunity, he'll pinpoint the spot and then leap as high as he can, because they're not very big, because he's got to punch down through the snow and collapse everything there. And their success rate for an adult fox, usually, I would guess, maybe 30%, when I've had a chance to watch them hunt for a while.
When they make that big leap, and they probably need that mouse out in that cold.
Yeah, it's a tough way to make a living. I wouldn't want to have to smash my face into the snow to get every meal I had.
Yeah, but you've smashed across a lot of that snow. Talk to us about the wildlife's interaction with the geysers. They're such a famous feature here. You've got beautiful photographs of sort of winter eruptions of geysers. There's one just bathed in pink here. You've got buffalo near them. Does the wildlife pay much attention? Are they sanctuaries, the warmth and water around these geysers in winter, or do they just stroll on by?
They're sanctuaries, actually, because they don't have enough food out there as a rule to keep them alive and maintain their fat levels all winter long. So they seek out places that they don't have to burn up energy just to stay warm. So they'll sleep on the ground next to the geysers and the hot springs. They'll also stand in the steam itself. And, of course, it's like a sauna in a way. And they, the good news, bad news, they're there because it's a little easier to stay warm. But then if it's a bad winter, they'll run out of food, and then they can't leave because there's too much snow around.
So they're trapped.
There's a lot of winter kill. They're kind of trapped, correct?
What about you surviving? What do you pack in with? You're on cross-country skis. I read you carry a 70-pound pack. That's a lot. And you sleep under, not in a tent, but just under a tarp. You said somewhere along the way, you said tents are for sissies. Really? In Yellowstone, midwinter?
That's right. Well, I try to travel as light as I can, and that's the main reason when I do a solo trip, I don't take a tent, because it's too heavy. And so this little silly 8-foot square nylon tarp, I can build this little shelter and get me out of the wind and keep some of the snow off of me. And so it's a matter of economics in terms of weight.
But are you drifted in by morning? How do you set up? Mm-hmm. It's just a blue tarp here, a few feet this way and that. And what, you end up with a snow blanket in addition to your sleeping bag?
Well, it's not uncommon for my shoes to be full of snow or frozen solid. And it's not a Holiday Inn by any means, but it's I'm able to stay warm. That's the key. And I have a 3-pound down sleeping bag. I've used about three of them over the years. And they're rated to 20 below zero, and I've had them slept in them out as cold as 45 below zero. So I don't trust the ratings on them, but it's mainly just trying to be as efficient about carrying weight. And, so my 70-pound pack, I have about 25, 30 pounds of camera gear. I'm not going anywhere unless I can make some photographs while I'm out there. There's food, as much food as I can carry. But I have a number of sources of this, how many calories I burn in a day. And it's somewhere between 9,000 to 12,000 calories a day.
Which your food cannot replace. You lost 18 pounds on one of these long treks across Yellowstone, as I recall.
Right. It's the Murphy diet. But but it's, I just can't, not only can I not eat that much food, I can't carry that much food. So I always lose weight on my trips. And it's kind of the payoff, I guess, for the rewards are the photographs and the experiences out in the backcountry of Yellowstone. One of the experiences I like to relate to people about almost a spiritual experience was I was on my solo trip across the park. I was out on near the top of Two Ocean Plateau, and I'd been out there about 3 days in from the south entrance, and stopped for a snack, and I heard this real regular thumping sound. And I thought I was out there by myself, so I look around and listen again, and It was my heart beating.
Oh, just you and your human heart.
Right. Wow. And then, from then on, the entire trip, in my sleeping bag, or I'd stop and listen, and it was there all the time, which I've decided was a good thing.
all in all.
Right, right.
And yet that means you're alone with that one. We've got so many listeners who want to speak with you, Tom. Let me turn to another caller from Nashville, Tennessee. Jerry's calling. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm having a real serious attack of envy.
I did too. Look at the pictures, then you really will.
Oh, and yeah, I guess I've been hooked on the outdoors. My father was a missionary in South Africa, and I remember as a child going to Victoria Falls, and we were the only people there. It was a park bench and a little wooden sign. But I've been out in the Rockies, and I've hunted out there quite a bit, and I have a lot of fear, I guess, now about climate and change. I want these places to be there forever, but I'm afraid they're not. And I guess I would ask you if what changes have you seen over the last 27 years in respect to, well, particularly climate and possible global warming?
Jerry, I'm sure that question is on a lot of listeners' minds. Tom, what do you say?
I've seen quite a lot of radical change, actually. Less snow, particularly in the last 10 years. It's tough to be out and do a ski trip now. I used to ski as late as the first part of April, and 20 years ago, and now I can't. It's basically mud and rocks, and it worries me because the snow cover is less, it's drier, and it's warmer. So in some ways, it may be good news in the short term for things like elk. They can get more food, but they're damaging the grasslands and that sort of thing. So it's happening. I have no doubt about it. And I've seen a lot of changes. The most obvious one is less snow and warmer.
We hope these images don't become images of a passing landscape. But we imagined that question would come up and come up strongly, Tom. And anticipating that, we also invited in John Varley to join us for a few minutes here, if we can all sit around the campfire. John's with us from Bozeman, Montana. He was worked and lived in Yellowstone National Park for 33 years, a field biologist, chief of research at Yellowstone, and was director of the Yellowstone Center for Resources, retired just last February. So he's like you, Tom. He's got the long view here. John Varley, thanks very much for joining us from Bozeman today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tom Murphy's here as well. John, as the biologist who spent all those decades in the park, what about this question of global warming and the Yellowstone environment generally? How do you see the health? What's the trend line?
Well, in relationship to the climate, I couldn't agree more with Tom Murphy. There is less snow. It is drier. It is warmer. We've witnessed that, both Tom and I, and in our brief careers in Yellowstone.
If we come back in a century or two, do you expect Yellowstone will be recognizable may be the wrong word, the features are all there, but will it have the same feel, or are we headed somewhere else given what's going on with the climate?
Well, the scientists like to take the long view, and of course 12,000 years ago it was Yellowstone was covered with 1,000 or more feet of glacial ice. And then 5,000 years ago, it was much warmer and drier than it is now. Now, those are two very different landscapes in just the last 15,000 years.
Does that leave you impartial about where it goes next, or is that what you're suggesting?
No, I'm not impartial. I care too much about that place, and I'm one of those who believe that humans have had something to do with altering the climate, what is going on right now is unprecedented in the geologic record.
Tom, what about yourself? Do you worry that your photos will become images of a lost world?
Unfortunately, I think there's some truth to that. I think that the dynamics of the wildlife movements and heavy snow cover, I think, may be over for a long time. You know, in the long term, like John talks about, who knows what's going to happen for sure. But in the short term, we're headed someplace radically different. And, you know, I don't generally think it's a good thing myself. Warmer and drier for a long time is going to, Yellowstone's not going to be the same in a lot of ways.
Makes us all the more glad you've been out there. Barbara's joining us from North Scituate, Rhode Island. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning, Tom.
I
watched
morning.
Your film on WGBH Boston about 2 weeks ago.
This was the Christmas
Yellowstone. I turned it on 5 minutes after it started. I'm not sure of the title.
Christmas in Yellowstone, and Tom Murphy's kind of the star of the show. He makes
yes.
a lot of appearance there.
And I know about his down sleeping bag and how he lets it fluff up.
That'll air again on Christmas Eve. Yeah, lets it fluff. What did you make of that scenery, Barbara?
Well, my late twin brother was an Arctic geographer and photographer. And in a way, this was spiritual, sort of sad, and I'm sort of glad he's not here. He's been dead for more than 10 years to see what's happening to his polar bears and the ice floes and the snow and the ice. It is so beautiful and so quiet. And I really enjoyed Tom Murphy's sort of tiptoeing on skis through the park, not scaring anything.
We love it. Barbara, thank you.
And getting those fabulous pictures, particularly of that fox.
That's right.
That foxy little fox, a red fox, is pretty wonderful. Do you tiptoe on your skis, Tom Murphy?
Well, I just kind of stumble along. If you got 70 pounds on your pack, you don't do anything real fancy.
Yeah. And John Varley, as a biologist, what about the impact of photos like this? Is this what keeps people plugged in? We can't all visit Yellowstone in the winter, but we can sure look at it right here.
Well, that's right. And Tom Murphy is a real pro at what he does in engendering the magic and awe and inspiration that has made Yellowstone one of the most famous parks in the world.
John Varley in Bozeman, Montana, 33 years as field biologist in Yellowstone National Park. Mr. Varley, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Tom, you stumbled, as you say, into those woods and mountains, and you come out a kind of hero bringing these images home. You intersected well with the time, if a little sadly, with the climate changes.
Right, right, yeah. Well, I plan on doing it a long time yet, but, you know, the wildlife thing, the dynamics are going to change as the climate changes, so there's something going to be happening, and Yellowstone is sort of residual, unfortunately, a relatively small segment of what used to be wild in this continent, and so that's what keeps drawing me back. Something's going to change there, but if it's managed well, if we're paying attention as much as we can, it's going to be the best we have.
We're going deep into the Yellowstone winter this hour with photographer Tom Murphy. He's been packing and shooting across Yellowstone National Park for 27 winters now, when the days are short and the snow is deep and the wild owns the wilderness. His book is Silence and Solitude, Yellowstone's Winter Wilderness. You can see him on Christmas Eve in the PBS documentary, nature documentary, Christmas in Yellowstone. Pam's calling from Florence, Massachusetts. Hi, Pam. You're on the air with Tom Murphy.
Hi. Thank you. I really love this show. I just wanted to say that I'm a singer and a songwriter and a writer, and I spend most of my time lately trying to write about how the earth is changing. It's a difficult thing to do. Mm. And my question is, can I go with you?
Your question and that of thousands of others, no doubt. What do you say, Tom?
I'm very quiet, and I can carry baggage.
You'll carry baggage. There's an offer, Tom Murphy.
That's kind of hard to turn down because I'm always carrying too much stuff, but bring extra cookies when you come.
Well, what about it? Do you ever go in accompanied, or is it necessarily a solitary trip?
It's hard to find people who actually show up. I like company, and it's trade-off, breaking trail, and that sort of thing. It's great.
Because it's too tough, too cold, too long in there, you mean?
Correct. It's very difficult. It's a lot of work. I've only had about a half a dozen people who've ever done two trips with me or more. And one fellow, a friend of mine, Larry, has gone on about six trips with me, and he always shakes his head about the second day and says, we always end up in the trees. We're always skiing through the trees, climbing over downfall on skis with a 70-pound pack. And like I said, we're burning, you know, 9 to 12,000 calories. And so it's hard to find people who actually stick with it. And
Well, Pam's waving her hand there. Maybe she's willing.
Right.
Livingston, Montana, you can find.
That's right. That's
Tom
right.
Murphy, just north of Yellowstone, Pam. Thanks
well,
for
one
that.
Of the things that talks people out of this, in Yellowstone, you're traveling across there, most of the streams are frozen. You're on under 10 feet of snow. But sometimes they're not. There's some thermals in there. And I was crossed across the Snake River one time, mm-hmm. and I knew that I had to cross it, and with no bridge, no ice. So I brought a little pair of wool socks, and I ski up to the shore of the river and take off my clothes. I'm naked from the waist down, put everything on my pack.
Because you can't get that wet in that cold, right? Okay.
No, you don't want to get your shoes and clothes sort of wet, and it's 5 degrees.
But you don't want to be naked from the waist down either, exactly.
Not for very long. So I put my wool socks on and waded the river. It's a little above my knees, and my feet were numb by halfway across anyway, but... got the other side, put my clothes back on as fast as I could, and then took off skiing to warm up. And I only made it about 50 yards till I found out I was on an island.
Oh, so you'd have to do it all over again.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens.
Yes, I bet
so
you
I,
do.
I had to dip the socks in the river this time to thaw them out because they'd frozen solid and wade across the second part. And it was about waist deep, the second part.
Boy, Pam, there's what you're signing up for. Be careful what you volunteer to do. Let me take
That's
a call
right.
from Augusta, Georgia. And Anna. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. What are you thinking?
Great. I'm sorry. I'm in the gas station. You know you have to have the power. No, I'm just so excited about this show. My daughter, who is currently 10 years old, has been wanting to study wolves since she could talk. I mean, seriously. So, Mr. Murphy, you are living the life that she wants. I need to know, how do I help cultivate this and help her direct her studies or whatever to help her get into this?
Okay, Tom Murphy, how about it? Mom wants to help a 10-year-old daughter prepare for the life of Tom Murphy. What do you say to her?
Well, the first thing she needs to do is spend as much time as possible outside in as wild a place as she can be. That experience of connecting with the land is the most important thing. You can expand that interest in wolves to other things because they're all interrelated and extremely valuable. And you can pick one, but you have to understand as much of the rest of it as you can. And the main thing is you need to be out there. And so take her out, start out in comfortable places like the local city parks and just keep pushing that and make it a positive experience. It will be if she can connect with the land.
You describe growing up on a big cattle ranch, having to walk a mile or two sometimes to get to do the chores there through the snow. So you had plenty of that early on, but it wasn't cattle you wanted to hang out with. Anna's daughter loves wolves, and I can see from your photographs that they haven't been back long at Yellowstone, really, but you clearly love them, too. Talk to us about the wolf in Yellowstone, when it came back and what its presence is like there now.
Well, it's been the country's made some mistakes in terms of wildlife management, and we as a country killed them all off by the 1920s. And one of the best things we did now was to bring the wolf back because the top predators are just as important as any of the other animals on that whole pyramid in a sense of life. And in 95 and 96, we brought the wolf back, and it's been extremely important to do that for the health of the entire ecosystem, and that's I've had an opportunity to see that happen. I've known Yellowstone Park before they were here, watching how elk moved and all these other creatures made it, and to see the change, very positive change of the introduction or reintroduction of the wolf.
Now the wolf would feed on the elk, but it's a positive change anyway. in what sense?
They feed on the elk. That's their main diet. They're certainly never going to eliminate the elk because they lived together for millions of years. And so when we showed up, they were fine. But what happens is we removed the wolf and the dynamics of the elk changed. And part of that was their feeding behavior. For example, they would end up browsing aspens and willows and destroying and disturbing the riparian areas. Mm-hmm. And now the wolves are back. And they keep those elk dispersed, we're starting to see regeneration of stands of willow and aspens. And with that, you get the beaver coming back, you get warblers nesting in those willow thickets, you know, the wolves are not out there trying to help the warblers, but they're doing what they do. But because of their dynamics with the ungulates, everything else goes back to a better, more dynamic system.
And what about your relationship with the wolf in winter in Yellowstone when you're staggering along with a backpack full of food and what else there? Do they look at you as lunch? How do they relate to a human way out in the middle of snowy Yellowstone?
They don't want anything to do with people. They don't like people at all. there's only been one instance of a healthy wolf hurting or killing a person in North America, and that was Little Red Riding Hood.
Right.
So that they're nobody's going to be hurt by wolves.
Can you get near them? Do they stay very far away? And what about the sound of the wolf? You say it's not exactly a howl, but more like a deep hum.
Yeah, you can't get anywhere near them. You can maybe pop over the hill and surprise them, but as soon as they see you, they're going to take off. They don't want anything to do with you. They won't even go near the roads most of the time. They travel across the roads in the Yellowstone in nighttime, usually when there's nobody there.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a chance to see them, but they're always going to be a long ways away.
And that hum you're describing, you describe it as a gorgeous sound. What's it like?
It's wonderful. It's not. Coyotes have a sort of a yelp and a bark.
Mm-hmm.
And a howl, and wolves' sound is referred to as a howl, but the best description I would have is a low hum, like a Gregorian chant. Multiple wolves will work off each other I'm not a musician, but an octave or so different, and so they kind of up and down humming sounds, and it's absolutely a magical sound. It's just as exciting to hear them as it is to see them.
There you are, folks, deep in a snowdrift under a blue tarp in the middle of the night with wolves as Gregorian chant in the middle of Yellowstone National Park. Tom Murphy, we appreciate your bringing that to us. Let's take a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and Joan. Hi, Joan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your stories are reminding me of my trip last summer to Yellowstone for 2 weeks. I wanted to say that I went out to see Old Faithful erupt, and there was just a small group of people there. It was a beautiful sunny day, and the geyser went off, and I decided to sit and meditate a few minutes. And when I turned around, there wasn't a soul around. There were maybe six or eight bison nearby, and the brilliance of the sun on the snow and the stillness, I actually live on the East Coast, but the stillness was just so incredible that your discussion here is bringing back those pleasant memories. And I was with my daughter, who is a wildlife biologist, and the woman who called about her daughter, the way to raise a wildlife biologist is to be out, as you said, outdoors, camping, hiking, fishing, skiing, sledding. So I wanted to share that with you.
Joan, we love the image of you meditating there all on your own at Old Faithful. That's terrific. Let me get another call from Pocatello, Idaho. Carrie's on the line. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Yes. I go up to Yellowstone in the winter with my sons a couple of times. We always, when we go, we take and we have a sleds and we've got a harness I built and pull that along. And I'm just curious, have you ever tried that? And if not, why not? Because we found it to be quite easy to get the gear in with us.
You're saying you pack in your gear on a sled behind you. Tom Murphy, your style?
I've traveled with people who have drug sleds, and their experience is after about 3 days they hate the sled. It's nice to get the weight off your back, but the problem that I've experienced or watched, I haven't drug a sled, is that on side hills in the backcountry in deep snow, it's a lot of work to drag that, and it has a tendency to drag you sideways down the hill and flip upside down. And I mean, I spent a lot of time following this sled along, keeping it upright
right,
with my pack on my back. But yeah, if you've got a couple of people, the first one breaking trail is going to work a lot harder than anybody else. You know, there are advantages to both. But
take a sled, take a pack, but in you go. Let me get another call from Nashville, if I may, Tom. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air with Tom Murphy.
Hi, gentlemen. I was wanting to ask Tom, I had the pleasure of working three different seasons as a park employee in Yellowstone, and just the experience of my life, love it. It's still, when the Bible refers to the sanctuary, for me, I always envision Yellowstone. And I was wondering if you might reflect on how your experiences there has changed you and the others that you have seen come and go from and really live in the park for extended periods of time like you have, and how you see that change them. I think that might be interesting.
Tom Murphy?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Changed my life. And I grew up in a wild area, this 7,500-acre cattle ranch. There were no lights for miles and miles, and it was quiet, and you could see the stars, the northern lights, and so I had a connection initially, but Yellowstone is a special place. It's hard to describe it. There's a spiritual reawakening that's possible there, and it's just a matter of being able to stop and spend the time. We're bombarded with sounds and motion and in the modern world, and just going out. The young woman with her little daughter with the wolves, just go out there and sit and listen and watch. And Yellowstone will give you anything you want in terms of connection with the land. It's, again, mostly wild. And if you can calm down and spend some time, and you can make that connection. And lots of people do. Get out of your car, just walk. In the summertime, even walk a quarter of a mile from the road, and I guarantee you it'll change your life.
You know, speaking of sound and motion, we can't look at winter in Yellowstone without asking about snowmobiles. President Clinton, as he was on his way out, as I recall, banned them, but they're back now. How big a presence is that for you when you're out there looking for that solitary moment? 700 and some, is it a day, snowmobiles allowed into Yellowstone? How big a footprint do they leave?
They leave a very large footprint, and there's been argument that, well, Harley-Davidson makes more noise than a snowmobile in the summertime, but it's a different experience in the winter. I've skied across the Central Plateau one time. At one point, I was 12 miles from the nearest road in any direction, and I could hear snowmobiles in the background all day long and half of the night.
Wow.
And there's an element of the spiritualness, I keep coming back to that idea that you can go ride a snowmobile millions of miles in other places. There should be some sanctuary for people, and more importantly, there should be some sanctuary for wildlife and wild land to go off and do what's necessary for itself. Mm. And I, for that main reason, I don't think they're appropriate. And it's a real complicated, and it's a good way to get into a fight in a bar in Livingston, Montana, but right. Wolves and snowmobiles. But again, what's really valuable, what's the most important part about Yellowstone is this sense and this real, not more than just a sense, but this real presence of wild land. And I think our obligation is to keep that. It's been a park for 130 years, and it was a wild land for a million years before that. And I believe it's arrogant and selfish to take that for a short-term gain right now.
Mm. Tom Murphy, we love your photographs. And again, listeners, they'll be up there for you to see just as long as you like at onpointradio.org. They're beautiful. Also in Tom Murphy's book, Silence and Solitude. You're headed for Antarctica and then back to Yellowstone. And the snow will be waiting. You've got wonderful avalanche stories as well. No fun to be in it, but awfully exciting. Snow has its own life there.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, they travel in the backcountry. You've got to be real careful about where you go. Even though Yellowstone is mostly a high plateau, there's a lot of big mountains. And the Park Service is, of course, real nervous. They have to go find you if you don't come out. And one of the skills you should have as a backcountry skier is to recognize what's safe and what isn't. And I've been in two avalanches, and the first one I was buried up to my waist, and it's pretty exciting. It's a pretty intense 30 seconds.
An intense 30 seconds, an amazing 27 years chronicled in these photographs. I'm looking here at snowdrifts that look almost like beautiful human bodies all in a row. Here at the print of a bird in the snow, the fog through these pine trees, the long lines of elk snaking through the snow. Tom Murphy, we're so grateful to you for these images and for your time today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you made a connection with people.
And there's a little Yellowstone in winter. Tom Murphy was our guest. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.